hike rates this month.
Rates might need to rise because we are maybe seeing some distortions in capital markets because of the Fed policy.
So clearly, this is a bad environment to be raising rates, and yet we have some of these more hawkish members of the Fed talking about how rates should be raised even twice between now and year end.
These guys baffle me. They're supposed to be data dependent, and the data is not at all that good.
Now, in terms of what the Fed's trying to do, they need to get to a more balanced probability around the meeting. But otherwise, there's no point in meeting if everyone's absolutely sure they're not going to do anything.
If they insist on pushing something through in September, I think they cannot begin to imagine what kind of market shock there may be. The market's not ready for it at all.
We are looking right now pretty much at a sea of red on Wall Street.
Well, I think gold is more than interesting now.
Some policymakers are getting stir crazy.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the week started out on a nice note. We had weak economic activity coming out with the ISM non-manufacturing report with a steep drop. That sent stocks higher earlier in the week as the anticipation of a September rate hike became less and less. But on Friday, things reversed themselves and we ended up negative for the week. As one Fed governor came out, we may need to raise interest rates because the economy is in danger of overheating. That doesn't sound right, does it? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray will be joining us. Now, if you remember Craig, at the beginning of the year, he was probably one of the most optimistic forecasters in terms of the S&P this year. He said it was going to hit 2350. That is Craig's forecast, and you're going to want to hear why he thinks that's still a possibility, even despite this downturn that we're seeing here on this Friday with the market down almost 400 points. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what drove the markets this week, and Keith Barron will be joining me in his commentary on the gold bull market he thinks still lies ahead of us and where to invest if gold prices head higher. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler, and you know what, Jim, I actually agree with that. I've always thought the term that the market, that the economy was heating up too much, and I would want to say, you mean we're having too much prosperity, and that's not good. Think about the bizarre idea that is. We're doing too well, but that's the term that they use. Well, we're going to talk in the big picture today about the recession that, sort of isn't. At least not yet. We have to wait until reality becomes real. We discuss the Federal Reserve a lot here on the program. And the reason why we do that is what the Fed does, or even hints at doing, actually moves the market. Friday, the market went down 300 points on just a comment by a Fed governor that maybe things were heating up just a bit. There's that comment again. And we needed to raise interest rates to slow it down. And that's what the market reacted to. However, with all of this optimism that we're seeing out there, and of course, there's no talk about it in the political section, the leading economic indicators don't seem to indicate an overheating economy, but rather one that's on life support and heading towards a recession next year. So nobody's talking about it, but there it is, and it's heading our way. And what does that mean? What's the status with it? And then we'll talk about that. Let's assume the idea that we are headed towards some kinds of a peak and then a turnaround. What does it look like as right as we get to the peak? What changes do you have to make in your investment? And then, well, what about the chances of another hard landing? Is that why people are so skittish like they were back after 2007, 2008? And what can you do? All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour is just getting started. And first, welcome back, Ryan Poplava, from our usual annual NewsHour vacation at the end of August. And nothing happened that caused an emergency program to be produced this year. You know, we always speculate on that every year. Well, we're post-Labor Day now. Most traders are back as well in full swing. And we were hoping to see increased volumes on the trading floors and a lot more volatility. But it looks like more of the same in September. And wow, I mean, it is interesting to see that the markets were as tame as they were on Friday following the news that North Korea did another nuclear test. But at the very same time, they dropped off 300 points because one of the Fed governors said, well, maybe we need to raise rates, you know. So,
yep.
Who can tell what these markets are going to do?
Yeah, it always just re-solidifies that the Fed, European Central Bank, Bank of England, they're in the driver's seat. And they've been that way for, gosh, how many years? 2010? Nine? Forever, it seems. And the sort of thing with, you know, the terrorist attacks and the nuclear tests from Korea, the market has been taking those in stride because, you know, unless it disrupts an economy, traders, you know, while sympathetic, everyone is towards the attacks that went on in England, we've come to understand news like this will not likely have sweeping economic fallout, however devastating it really is. But, you know, hopefully we don't see any kind of event that can potentially do that. You know, no one would want to see anything along those lines. But definitely it would be naive to say it's not possible in our highly technically integrated society from a cyber attack, you know, the fallout on power grids, et cetera. But, you know, back to the markets, John, this week, like I said, drivers, it's been the central bank. They're in the driver's seat. So, you know, when we have, when have they not been? Maybe only during an earnings announcements is it really anything other than central bank this, central bank that.
Yeah, I can actually see it sort of like the movie, you know, London Has Fallen, like, oh, London doesn't exist anymore. Did we make a profit today or what?
It's like drinks still open, right? Hit down that block on the other side. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Well, were there any central bank meetings this week that we should be especially concerned about? Or as I mentioned when I came in, the governor of a Fed or other officials making speeches that suddenly got everybody's attention? And here I'm thinking especially of Jeffrey Grunlock, but go ahead.
Jeffrey Grunlock, founder of Double Line Capital, he said on Thursday, you know, need to get defensive. And he's definitely had some influence in the markets. My brother's been to a couple of his conferences. He did a fixed income one back last year with, I think, ETF.com. He's definitely had some very sage-like intuition on things. And yeah, definitely interesting to hear him say some of those things. But yes, a central bank policy meeting did occur this week. It was on Thursday, European Central Bank. And they did leave rates unchanged across a spectrum of their facilities. And they also, they did not increase or prolong the asset purchase program, which is currently, if our listeners don't know at this point, it's about 80 billion euros a month across, like I said, a wide spectrum of fixed income securities, including, I believe, corporates now. In the press conference, Mario Draghi said that the baseline scenario is still the same with some downside risk. And of course, he did the staple, willing to do more and use all available monetary policy tools. But, you know, he said there were no discussion at this meeting to extend the purchase program, and that alone helped to rally the euro and stir some selling in the European sovereign debt. So that was a pretty key thing on Thursday. Just doing nothing can actually do something.
Yeah, that's very, very true. But, you know, if we go back to the policy divergence that PFS Group's been talking about since 2014 with the Fed removing accommodation while the rest of the world has been stepping on the gas for more, do you finally see some kind of an inflection point where all of the countries may be moving in step to keep the status quo? Or maybe what? Maybe this is an and/or situation, and/or begin to normalize?
It's really hard to say. You know, there was a step up in actually imports for China for the first time in 22 months. And there's been some progress there. But, you know, we're of the opinion the Federal Reserve in the U.S., yes, they want to normalize. All of the voting members continue to have these speeches, including this week, Boston Fed President Rosengren Friday, and some non-voters like San Francisco President Williams. Williams even said September's on the table in his opinion and tried making the case for sooner rather than later to normalize rates. But, you know, the economics, John, and political events like the Brexit issue, investors are paying attention to and won't let the Fed presidents get away with raising rates with, you know, economics still kind of floundering. You know, look at the ISM numbers that came out, et cetera. But yeah, back to Jeffrey Grunlock, you know, he said on Thursday after that ECB meeting, when we saw a correction in some of the sovereign bond debt over there, he said that, you know, we could be looking at a situation where bond investors need to get defensive. What does that mean? Essentially, he's saying, you know, lower your allocation there, which he thinks will begin based on the anticipation that inflation will be detected by the markets soon on the long side of the curve. It's our personal opinion that a correction in the bond market could potentially also lead to a precursor of the end of the bull market in equities, not end all be all of the secular bull market, but possibly create a cyclical bear market. And that would be based on higher interest rates, really restricting credit, which is typically what monetary policy does eventually when they get in that zone. But also, gosh, look at the federal budget. As soon as interest rates go up, it's going to make things very tight for government spending, which is a very huge component of the economy. So I don't know. The telltale sign is typically an inverted yield curve for a recession and a correction in the economy. And that's based on, you know, monetary policy being very aggressive, steepening the short side of that curve, and the long end detecting weaker economic progress in the future. So that could be another year out from now. You know, I'm not a crystal ball foreteller here. I don't have my big fortune cap on, but that is essentially the development of bear markets in the past and based on corrections in the economy.
Yeah, and despite what Fed officials say, you know, Janet Yellen and the Fed's committee continue to respond in their policy statements that they are data dependent, and the data really weren't that good this week if we look at it. Although on the other hand, you know, a lot of times you get the seemingly contradictory statement from the Fed governors, and that's different from the committee, but you always wonder what's going on. But anyway, the data weren't too good this week, were they?
No, and back to Rosengren, he specifically said that the data they're looking at, so everyone always is asking, okay, what are you looking at? They're not very transparent on that. But clearly, if you look at how the market reacted this week, you're right, some of the economic numbers were not that great. And in review, you know, we didn't have the wrap-up last week. The jobs report was disappointing. The market was expecting more. And coming off of the July great run and also in June, July was at 255,000 ads. Last month, 151. So underwhelming. And then going into this week and a little bit of last week, ISM manufacturing and services were both weaker than what they were the month before. Looking at manufacturing, you know, registered a minor contraction. Anything below 50 is a contraction. It was at 49.4. And services dropped from 55.5 back in July to 51.4. The lowest it's actually been all year. So that's got to be concerning for the market, but not enough to really cause a correction. It's just enough to say that, well, Fed's not going to go in September, so we're okay in equities. But, you know, the probability is, I was just looking at the Fed futures for September. Right now, it's set at about 24% probability of a quarter point hike and about 44% in December, down a little bit from where it was about a month ago, up in the 50s for December. So back down a little bit due to some of the recent developments.
So I'm guessing here that it's not whether the data were good or bad, but whether they influenced the Fed to move or not. That seems to be the real issue. Let's face it.
They're in the driver's seat.
They're in the driver's seat. That's what Jim and I are going to be talking about today on The Big Picture. You know, we are a monetary policy driven market, whether we want to be or not. That's just the way it is right now. And the focus on individual companies is really rare when you look at it. So anyway, Ryan Poplava, appreciate your update on things. It's going to be important to follow the bond market in the weeks ahead to see if that inflection point you were talking about is like Jeffrey Gundlach mentioned. Anything else on the horizon that we should watch for as we plow into the fall season?
Yeah, it's essentially the monetary policy statements this month. There's the Bank of England next week, and then we go right into the Bank of Japan and the Federal Reserve in the following weeks. So that's definitely going to continue to influence the direction, and anything that would kind of develop and influence their decision would be, of course, the economics. So those will be important to watch. If England and Japan also keep the status quo, that could further hurt the lower for longer trade, essentially those seeking yield in bonds. We saw a little bit of weakness towards the end of the week this week, utilities and high dividend paying stocks. So the lower for longer trade has been hiding out in those areas, has done well with interest rates falling. If Gundlach's right and interest rates head up, well then, like you said, get defensive in bonds. But you have to also think about those other lower yielding areas that many investors have been hiding in for income.
All right. It's good to be back in the saddle again here, so to speak, and appreciate it, Ryan Poplava. I don't know if the fall is going to be boring or exciting. I haven't figured that one out yet.
Yeah, there's this debate. It's always the debate. Are they going to go? Are they not? And that'll be at every single meeting. That's been the case all year long. But if you look at the Fed futures, what the Fed futures are telling us is don't really worry until December, but we've also got the elections coming up. So maybe we will be able to talk about something else.
And wouldn't you love to see a movie sometime? You know, these guys are running down the street, running from zombies or something, like The Strain's back on again right now. You know, picks out his cell phone. Quick, call my broker. Something like that.
Yeah, just gosh, looking at Trump and Hillary in a zombie apocalypse movie, you know, who'd win?
You mean Donald Clinton and Hillary Trump? Is that who you're talking about? All right. See you again next week, Ryan.
All right. We'll see you, John. Take care.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The U.S. is in the midst of a massive credit boom, which has driven the stock market to record highs. Is it about to end and come all crashing down? Or does the credit-led bull market we see today still have some years left to run? To help answer that question for us today is Brian Reynolds. He's the chief market strategist at New Albion Partners. And Brian, you discuss three very important themes when it comes to understanding the credit boom and bust cycle, particularly as we see it playing out today in the U.S. Let's talk about the first theme that you highlight driving U.S. markets currently, which you say could even possibly rival what we saw in the 1990s leading up to the tech bubble.
Well, I think it's not only going to rival the 1990s, I think it's going to exceed it, because our nation's public pension funds have grown to the point where they dwarf the Federal Reserve. Since Detroit went bankrupt in 2012, those pensions have realized they're underfunded, and their current and future retirees are on the hook for any shortfall. And so across this country, in the last 4 to 5 years, every major state has either thought about raising taxes or has raised taxes to bring more money into our pension system. And that money is getting allocated to our credit market. And so instead of worrying about if it's going to end, it's actually more likely to intensify in the next 2 to 3 years. But the pension funds' returns have been below their expectations. Most governors and legislatures have underfunded the pensions to the point where they need to make 7.5% per year. And they haven't done that, which means they need to be more aggressive in the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years to try to make their targets. Our public pension funds are far and away the biggest investors. Number two would be the insurance companies, and then the endowments and the foundations. And they all need to make between 6 and 7.5% in an interest rate environment that's extremely low, which means they need to invest extremely aggressively in order to have a chance of meeting their targets.
Well, typically the month of September and October are usually down months for the market. But here we are in the first week of September. All the markets are positive. Joining us on the program is Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, let's talk about seasonalities. Typically, September, October have not been known to be good months for the markets. Number one, why do you think that is? And number two, we seem to be varying from that pattern so far, but once again, it's still early in the month.
Well, thanks, Jim, for having me back on the program. I think there's a couple reasons why we're not seeing the kind of end-of-summer doldrums that we've typically seen in the market. Number one, when you don't get the sell-in-May-go-away phenomenon starting to sell off, you typically, and what we found with our work looking back in time, has been the market just kind of slowly grinds higher in the year end, and that kind of feels like what is happening now. The second thing I find interesting too, Jim, is that when we went back and we looked at the kind of volatility or trading range, what we found last month and the end of August is this is one of the narrowest trading ranges that we have seen. In fact, It was the fourth narrowest trading range for the month of August, dating all the way back to 1927. That really tells me that investors are not really sure what to do at this point in time. This market has been going higher. There's uncertainty with the political landscape in Washington. Investors have been looking for corrections. They're not getting them. They're confused as to why this market continues to trade higher. They've been sitting on the sidelines. Now, we've come back from the long and restful Labor Day weekend. The market's getting off to a good start, and it just every little dip feels like it's getting bought when I look at it from the macro perspective and from the individual charts. And to answer your question, why is this playing out this way? I think it's uncertainty. I think it's there's money been on the sidelines, and that money is finally starting to come back to work.
Do you think it also, Craig, has to do with the fact, I mean, plus you take a look at some of the alternatives out there. I mean, I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen of bond yields on sovereigns. They're mainly negative in Europe and in Asia. I mean, where else are you going to get a rate of return? I mean, you have what, a 2.1% dividend yield on the S&P and the 10-year treasury is a little over 1.5.
There's no question that TINA is alive and well. There is no alternative. And if you're an investor, you need to put your money to work. We need to save for retirement. We need to fulfill those basic obligations that we've got. Retirement, healthcare savings accounts, all these things. And yeah, nobody wants to sit around with a 0% rate of return. Not to mention that we're now seeing it every single day in the financial media. The market is making all-time new highs. And people are feeling a lot of remorse. And you can say we've gone from TINA to also FOMO, fear of missing out, starting to really come into play too. And in these kind of periods where you've got these dull markets, it's not a great time to be shorting these things, the overall markets with a lot of these factors coming into play. And might I also add in here, Jim, that investors are finally picking up on something we've talked about for a while, is that this market is shrinking. The number of shares outstanding on the S&P 500 have declined over 5% over the last couple of years. And also there's 25% fewer stocks today above a 25 million market cap and a $2 price than there was in 2000. And we continue to see M&A eat into that overall number of investable stocks.
You know, that's something that's been rather interesting about this bull market, Craig. Going back to 2009, some of the biggest drivers of this bull market have been central banks and corporations buying their own stocks. In other words, individual investors have been sort of on the sidelines for much of this bull market. You've had, what, several trillion dollars of corporate buybacks. You have central banks that are buying it. And Craig, what about the idea even of pension funds and insurance companies? I mean, I took a look at CalPERS last year. Their rate of return on their pension was 0.6%, and their assumptions for their retirees are 7% and 8% market returns. So how much of this is also going to be driven institutionally? In other words, if you're CalPERS and you have to get a 7-8% rate of return to fund your retirement benefits, where are you going to get that?
There's no other place to go besides finding good, high-quality, dividend-paying stocks, well-known franchises, large-cap stocks. They have to go in and buy some of those kind of names. There is, again, there is no alternative if you need to get a 7-8% type return. But realistically, though, they may have to go change those assumptions and lower them down to be more realistic to the current environment that we're in right now. But you're not getting it out of fixed income.
I want to talk about where some of the best returns have been in the market this year. You have the utility index that is up a little over 17%. You've had consumer staples do very well this year. You've had, obviously, the gold sector has been on fire with over 100% rate of returns. But also recently, Craig, you're starting to see things like the S&P Mid-Cap 400, the Small-Cap Index, and even the Russell is outperforming this year. What is that telling you when the small cap stocks start to outperform?
Well, it tells me a couple things. Number one, it tells me that the breadth of this market, meaning the amount of stocks that are participating, is starting to play catch up. We have heard many investors and many strategists bemoan for years that this market was too narrow, too little participation. And now that the participation is here, they're still not on board with an optimistic outlook for it. I am very happy when I see the breadth of the market continuing to expand. In fact, a lot of our intermediate term market timing gauges center around market breadth, and our gauges continue to show an expansion. The number of stocks making 26-week new highs, the number of our groups, industry groups, making 26-week new highs, the number of stocks and groups above their 40-week moving average. To me, expanding breadth with the Russell going up, with the value line being the best performing index year to date, that tells me that there's a lot of stock participation and that there's a lot of perhaps room for this market to continue. This is not a declining situation in terms of breadth. It's a healthy market, healthier than a lot of people are giving it credit for.
In your mind, is it this money that has been so cautious for so long that's sitting on the sidelines that may be one of the drivers here?
I think it is perhaps some of the individual investors that have been a bit nervous about this market. Again, I don't blame anybody. When you get cut in half twice from 2000 to where we are today, they're very apprehensive to put money to work. But when you look at what's happening with real estate, interest rates, everything else, and then you constantly hear about the market making all-time new highs in the paper, I suspect that you are starting to see some of that money gradually, cautiously come off the sidelines. And there was a very good chart that I've used in the past from our good friend that you know well, Ralph Acampora, and talk about stages of the market and where investors typically come back into markets, and they typically come back into some of the larger cap stocks first and foremost. We've already seen some of that happen, and then you graduate up into some of the mid-cap stocks, and again, that feels like that's starting to happen and the participation of this market continues to work. So again, a lot of things are working and doing the right things.
Now, at the beginning of the year, you had a forecast. In fact, you were probably one of the more bullish forecasters at the beginning of the year. Your target was 2350 for the S&P 500. And of course, at the beginning of the year, that kind of looked outlandish given what happened the first 6 weeks of the year. Here we are in September. We have the S&P at 2181, so 2350. Craig, that's almost another 8% gain going into the end of the year, which would put us in double digits for the year. You still hold to that forecast?
Absolutely. My forecast has not changed. And I think what we're going to see is this market continue to grind higher into year end. I was kind of doing the math over this over the weekend, doing a reality check. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, 1.5-2% kind of each month from here into year end. I think that is doable and achievable. So from my perspective, 2350 is absolutely achievable. And I think it will be done. No question mark in my mind. Money needs to go somewhere. The economy is not as bad as what people think the economy is at this point in time. In fact, I think it's been getting better. If you actually go back and you look at the leading economic indicators, LEI index, and I would encourage all the listeners to pull it up, you're at an interesting inflection point with that particular economic indicator. And one of the key pieces into that indicator is also stock price performance. So all these things are kind of turning up. The unemployment rate has been holding at pretty low levels. Again, things are better than what they're getting credit for at this point in time.
So, as you pointed out, and as I mentioned, we're starting to see some of the smaller cap indexes do very well. In fact, some of them in double digits. So that's attributed to, let's say, wider participation in the stock market, which is a good thing. If you were looking forward in terms of where are the best places to be, I mean, obviously since the beginning of the year, things like gold, the utility index, consumer staples have done very well. Going forward to the year end, to your 2350 target, what sectors do you think are going to drive that market higher?
Terrific question. So right now we are overweight the technology sector. We're also overweight basic materials and also energy. And Jim, I'd say this is the first time that we have been overweight the energy sector since 2009. And it looks like to us that a major bottom is getting formed in the price of oil. And a close above $50 on the price of oil would lead to, I think, a pretty strong acceleration in oil. And over the next coming, say, 12 to 18 months, you could see a target oil price somewhere in the $70 to $75 range. Now, rewind and think about what happened at the bottom of the market in 08 and 09. You had that classic-looking inverted head and shoulders pattern. It's almost the exact same type of pattern for oil right now. So from here to year end, if we get that close above 50, I think you're going to see a pretty good pickup, and you'll find some pretty good alpha in the energy sector because a lot of people have sold off their positions, or perhaps they've looked at some of these names and say, these are areas or these are stocks that may not have been around, but they're bouncing pretty hard. Inventory numbers, as you saw from today, have come down quite a bit, and it looks like there's going to be a good opportunity in those names in the year end. I'd also to say the optical stocks inside of technology, along with semiconductor stocks, are two other very good-looking areas inside the market. Yes, gold has done well, too. It's up meaningfully year-to-date. But I think you'll get more alpha out of energy and out of tech over the next several months than you will out of some of the gold trades at this point.
So, Craig, like in any kind of forecast, one of the things that we've seen throughout this bull market is we've seen sudden shifts that happen periodically. We go back and forth between the risk on and the risk off trade, depending on what the market wants to worry about, or maybe there's a temporary crisis. If there was something that would go awry with your forecast, what do you think that would be? In other words, what could trip that up?
Well, I always think about that question. And I think it's an absolutely terrific question. I think what could go wrong? And by the way, anytime you're asking for market advice, and what I would tell your listeners is ask them this question. What could go wrong, and see if they've even thought about what could go wrong with their forecast? Well, what could go wrong for me is, one, because the interest rates continue to fall. And if that is the case, that is going to be a scenario that would suggest that this is going to be lower for longer in terms of interest rates, which it would be a further problem for the overall global economy. Second is, we've got a wild card of what's happening in Washington. Lots of uncertainty could come out of this election coming up, and there's certainly a lot of noise happening in the marketplace. I would also say, you know, the third thing that I would be thinking about, and I have been thinking about, that can be the wild card out here is, you know, does the Fed raise rates? Does the Fed not raise rates? We've seen this market oscillating between kind of Fed raising rates, Fed not raising rates, and this kind of pretty quick sector rotation that's been happening in the market. So that's something that could certainly take some of the areas of the market that I've thought would do better and perhaps drag those down a little bit more and shift money back into some sort of the defensive areas of the market. So those are a couple things that I've been thinking about. There's always a huge list, but those are kind of the top three right now.
And we've seen that too, where, for example, we got the strong July numbers in employment, and all of a sudden the perception or the percentage of the market thinking the Fed was going to go in September. Then, of course, we had two numbers that came afterwards, and that perception changed. If, let's just take a scenario, the perception by the market right now is they'll wait before the election and go in December. If the Fed was to raise rates in December, do you think that would have anything to do with your forecast or would change it?
I don't think if they went in December, that would change my forecast at all. I think the Fed has been very patient. They're going to wait for this to show the clear signs of inflation with the various gauges that they're going to be looking at. I think all the conditions are right for them to go another 25 now. And I just think they're being cautious. And they've been surprised by many different, you know, geopolitical shocks out there, Brexit being one of them that kind of kept them on the sidelines. But I don't think them raising rates 25 is going to change anything in terms of my views on this market. It's probably going to validate them, actually, that the economy is strong enough for them to go up 25 basis points.
So if we were to sum up, you still sticking to your forecast at 2350. The areas you think are going to help lead that market to higher levels are going to be energy, basic materials, and technology. Some of the leaders at the beginning of the year, you're underweight, which has been consumer staples. And you're neutral on utilities. So you think that's the game to be played then here in, as we head into the end of the year?
It certainly is looking with our relative strength work that the market is positioning for higher interest rates. I would also say that the financial sector would do well. And as you know, Jim, and as the listeners who, you know, listen to our commentary over the last years know that I'm always overweight three sectors. I'm always underweight three sectors. So over and underweight three, and then neutral six. I'm battling every single week as I go through our weekly work to decide where we should be over and underweight. And I would say right now, the best relative strength are out of tech, basics, and energy. And I would say that if rates are going to get positioned up, I would say that large cap banks will do well in addition to those other names. So I'm looking for that incremental confirmation from the market itself instead of trying to guess and speculate, but let the market show me that that is really starting to gain traction. I am seeing some early indications that it is. You look at stocks like Goldman Sachs in here, which should be kind of the canary in the coal mine type names, and those look like terrific bottoms getting set in stocks like that.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, how can they do so?
You can either reach out to their Piper Jaffray salesperson, or I can be reached at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com.
All right, Craig. Well, listen, thanks for coming on the program. Look forward to that 2350 by the end of the year. That would be a nice return for all investors.
That would be wonderful. Thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Karen Covey. She's a divorce lawyer, mediator, and educator. She's author of a book called When Happily Ever After Ends. Karen, I want to start out the topic. Divorce is not a new subject for most Americans. We see a lot more divorces today. But let's talk about something that is somewhat different as you age. I mean, somebody in their 20s, they might have made a mistake. Maybe it was their high school sweetheart, maybe in the 30s and 40s. But all of a sudden now you're talking about somebody in their 50s and 60s. Why is that different?
It's different because when you divorce later in life, you're faced with finite resources. And basically that means you have less time and less money. So whereas somebody in their 20s, if they get financially devastated by divorce, they have a lifetime to recoup their losses. But somebody who's in their 50s, 60s, or 70s doesn't have the same amount of time, the same income earning potential to recoup what they've lost. So divorce later in life has a lot different financial impact. I mean, divorce never is good for anyone's financial life, but it's harder when you divorce later on in life. If you haven't saved a really substantial retirement nest egg, the result of a divorce later in life could be devastating.
Well, after declining for almost 3.5 years, one of the best performing sectors in the market this year has been the gold market. It's not just precious metals themselves, gold and silver, platinum and palladium, but it's also the gold mining stocks. Will this continue, or is just simply this a bear market bounce? Joining me on the program is Keith Barron. He heads up Urania Resources. And Keith, let's begin with the catalyst that sort of drove this market, because we began the beginning of the year, well, just about everything was going down, especially the commodities sector. Gold got down below 1,100. And here we are on the day you and I are doing this interview, and we've got gold prices in a very narrow trading range. So they've been around 325 to roughly 1,350. What do you think were the catalysts that turned this thing around? And then let's talk about what those catalysts might be going forward and what your views are.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for having me on the show again. I think really the fundamental change came in the very first week of January this year. And it came about when the Japanese decided, and the Germans started the discussion and then implemented negative interest rates. So, you know, up until that point, the argument against holding physical gold and silver had always been, you know, they have the cost to store it, the cost to handle it. It's vulnerable to theft and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it doesn't earn any interest. Well, you don't get any interest from the bank now. If you're in the bond market, there's negative interest for many of the bonds. And so people just chose that if they're going to keep a store of wealth, might as well stick it in the vault somewhere. So at the same time, we saw the gold market starting to revive, the price starting to come up. We saw tremendous buying in both Europe and in Japan of wall safes. You couldn't get one for love nor money because people were storing their bullion.
Yeah, I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen of global bond yields, Keith, and I don't care if you're looking at Japan, Spain, Italy, Germany, Switzerland. You've got negative interest rates. And in fact, the Bank of England is actually paying banks money to loan money. I'd like to get in the banking business. So basically, there's a negative carry on bonds right now, which makes gold much more attractive.
Indeed, yes. And these negative interest rates are providing a lot of incredible distortions now in the market. You know, if you went back through history and you talked to some of the founders of modern banking, the Medicis, and said, you know, many, many centuries in the future, people are actually going to pay the banks to hold their money, they'd be absolutely incredulous. This is something that hasn't happened before in recorded history. It's a complete construct. It's really crazy and topsy-turvy. And so now, you know, if you have an annuity or you're a bondholder, a pension fund holding bonds, you're looking at very little to no return at all. And this is really unprecedented.
Well, it really is. And I think in many ways, some of this has backfired. I know in Japan, when they went to negative interest rates, they thought it would stimulate the economy. But as you said, there was actually a run on safes in Japan because people were saying, I'm not going to keep my money in the bank and pay them money. I might as well stuff it in a mattress or a safe or do what some of them did. They went out and bought gold.
Absolutely, yes. And this is continuing. And then, you know, in Europe as well, on top of everything else, we've got bail-ins. So we've had banks that are changing the money that's held by account holders into shares of the bank. And these banks are already in very, very deep trouble. And the shares are illiquid. There was one very unfortunate gentleman at the beginning of the year in Civitavecchia near Rome who had 100,000 euros in an account. And when he found out that it had been changed into shares, he actually took a very, very drastic and tragic step and hung himself. Again, we saw bank bail-ins from Cyprus a couple of years ago, but very, very surreptitiously, a number of countries now have passed legislation to make it legal. I'm talking to you today from Toronto, Canada, and actually the Canadians have done this themselves, though there haven't been any bank bail-ins here yet. And I say yet guardedly, maybe that's coming in the future.
You know, that's something that we're starting to see more of. And I know a lot of investors have kept their money in cash because the markets have been confusing. It's been driven by central bank policies. I mean, that's all we talk about. Is the Fed going to raise? Are they not going to raise? Who's going to raise? Who's going to lower? And it's been very confusing for investors. So a lot of them have just stayed in cash. But I know that in Europe, a lot of those banks are in deep trouble. And you could see another banking crisis there, in which case there doesn't seem to be the mood by politicians to bail out the bankers. And so depositors could be at risk. Could this be another factor that's a driver for gold?
Oh, yes. I absolutely do think it's a huge factor. And in fact, in longer term, and I think that the euro and the EU is going to break up. I've been talking about this for a long time now. I did think up until really in the last year or so that the EU was going to break up as a consequence of the deaths of the pig nations, really the southern European nations like Spain, Portugal, Italy, also Malta, Cyprus, these places. But now I believe it's going to be fueled largely by immigrants that are coming mostly illegally from North Africa, some from the Middle East as well. Of course, we've seen some huge developments just in the last week, a regional election in former East Germany in what was formerly a stronghold of Angela Merkel's party, and they came third in a local election. I think this is really just the kind of a bellwether for what's going to happen next year when they have the national elections in Germany. And I think that there's a lot of discontent in Europe. I live in Europe myself. I live in Switzerland. We have a situation in Switzerland right now where the border has actually been closed between Switzerland and Italy near the city of Lugano. And there's a squatter camp of about 5,000 plus North Africans who are poised. They've come across via boats from places like Libya and Tunisia across the Mediterranean and landed in Italy and made their way up all the way to the border with Switzerland. And their objective is to get into Germany. Well, the Swiss have closed the border and they won't let them go anywhere. It's not widely reported in the media in Canada and the U.S. about what's going on in Europe. But certainly if you read any European paper or watch the TV, they talk about this constantly. There's 5,000 or 6,000 migrants arriving in the southern parts of Italy every day. And that's an incredible amount and puts an incredible strain on a country that's essentially broke. So I think what's going to happen later on, and I think there'll be a discussion early next year amongst the EU countries, and they're going to start saying you have to take a certain percentage of these migrants. And countries like Poland and Hungary and Finland have just simply said, no, they're not going to do it. And I think that essentially is what's going to break up the EU. And then we have incredible upheaval and volatility for the euro.
And Keith, what about this tax issue? I know there's a big spat right now between the EU and Ireland and Apple, wanting Apple to pay $14.5 billion in back taxes because they decided to locate in Ireland, which has a lower tax rate.
Yeah, well, that happened a couple of years ago when they had the emergence of what they called the Celtic Tiger. There were a lot of software companies that set up in Ireland because they have a very well-educated workforce, and they were working fairly cheaply compared to America. And so the Apple company, it would appear, used their financial heft and their influence to get a special tax deal where they almost paid no taxes at all. And the rest of the EU has cried foul on this. So I don't know what the fallout will be eventually for this. Of course, Apple is a company that works in many, many countries internationally, including, I would think, every country in the EU. So I think they're going to have to conform to what everyone else is doing. But, you know, there's all these regional problems going on, and Ireland doesn't like being dictated to by the rest of the EU. And we had the Lisbon Treaty a couple of years ago, and the Germans don't like to be dictated to by the Austrians, or there's all this stuff going on. The EU is a very fragile construct, I believe. There are too many regional and ethnic differences. It was a good idea at the time post-World War II, and I think it brought a lot of peace to the region, but it's had its day, and certainly now in a situation where the southern countries are so broke compared to countries like Germany, it's just a situation that really cannot continue indefinitely.
Let's talk about the industry itself, because after 3.5 years, you saw a lot of consolidation. A lot of the juniors went out of business. Companies were consolidated. Majors cut back on new mines, shut down some mines. What's the state of the industry right now from your perspective? And can they ramp up if they want to, if gold demand increases?
Well, that's an interesting question. I believe not. It generally takes about 10 years to get a new discovery permitted and operating, sometimes longer than that. In the U.S., pretty much every new discovery gets attacked by the NGOs, and the NGOs these days don't usually attack the mining companies with lawsuits and judicial things. They go after the agencies that grant the permits, like the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service and things like that. But we see this internationally, and, you know, every new project has a little bit of a rough ride. But, you know, essentially a lot of the easy stuff has been found around the world. Pretty much every part of the world has already been walked over and looked at by geologists, and the low-hanging fruit is gone. I had an interesting thing come across my computer this morning. Harmony Gold, which is a well-known company, and their partner White Rivers Exploration have just announced a discovery in the Free State in South Africa. And this is a good discovery. It's 11.5 million ounces, grading 8.9 grams per ton. However, when you go down and look at the press release, you'll see that the ore body lies between 0.7 and 1.4 miles down.
Wow.
Miles below the surface. And this is a situation that the industry faces. The easy stuff has been found. Now, Harmony has actually got another gold mine not too far away, and they'll be able to run some tunnels over from that mine and potentially exploit this thing. But this is really the way that the industry is today. Either the gold discoveries, the better discoveries, are not at surface. They have to find them through geophysics, through geochemistry, and they're at depth. Or the alternative is that they're exploiting things that are very, very low grade near the surface or at surface. And I was just looking today at the numbers for a well-known Canadian gold company, Detour Lake. And in their last quarter, they reported their grades as 0.92 grams per ton, 0.92. For most of my career, that would have been considered a geochemical anomaly, certainly never anything that was potentially mineable. Their recovery, as they state in their press release, is 89% of 0.92. It's pretty darn skinny. There's not a lot of room there for error. So 0.92 is essentially getting close to nothing. And that's typical. Most of the mines that are being exploited around the world are under gram now. And so we have a situation in the industry where we've had virtually no money spent on exploration and development for about 5 years. Now, it can't change overnight, of course. It's not like flipping a switch. But when the market started to come back in January, we saw companies starting to raise money for development. But these things take a long time. The discovery that I made back in 2006, Fruta del Norte, Lundin Gold owns it now, and they've just raised $91 million to develop it. That's the first tranche of money. But that will go in production in December of 2020. So that gives you an idea of how long it takes to commission a mine. It takes a long time. And we've got a situation here where the various companies that have looked at statistics and banks have forecasted that sometime in 2017, we actually fall off the cliff in terms of new gold supply from mines. It'll be the first time that we've seen probably in a century where world gold production is going to dip down.
So, Keith, if you were to play this market, I mean, there's various ways you can do it. You can buy individual stocks. You can buy the ETFs. You can buy bullion itself. In fact, you got an ETF for everything, whether it's gold, silver, platinum, or even the gold stocks. Buying gold is pretty straightforward. When it's coming to stocks, would you recommend people stay with a fund or an ETF? Because picking an individual gold mining stock, there's a lot of risk involved. There's the property itself, the location, there's geopolitical risk. And as you know, we've seen how many times over and over, even in the last decade, where a lot of mines turned out to be less than what they thought they were going to produce, or they had mining problems, or they had problems with government.
Yeah, certainly so. ETFs, I personally don't like. There was a story that has been out recently, just actually in the last week, on Zero Hedge about the travails of Deutsche Bank and an ETF that's been storing gold with Deutsche Bank. And apparently, Deutsche Bank has told the ETF that they can't have access to the gold and they can't get it back. I don't know what the real situation is there. Of course, Zero Hedge is not exactly the word from God. So I don't know what the truth of the matter is, but if you invest in an ETF, you're hoping that somebody's storing your gold for you and that it's actually there. I'm much more of a believer in having it physical in my own hands and storing it myself. And in terms of the market, you're quite right with political risk and country risk and project risk and all the rest of it. And I tend to favor the royalty companies like Royal Gold, like Franco-Nevada, Silver Wheaton, Sandstorm. These are companies that don't operate the mines themselves, but they own either streaming or royalties from the various operations. And the operations tend to be diversified in terms of commodity and also in terms of country. So they mitigate the risk that way. And even if one project should fall apart or get seized by the government or whatever, it doesn't mean that your stock becomes worthless because these things are so diversified. So that's what I like to do. The major players, the Newmonts, the Barricks of this world, I tend to shy away from. I do think in the future, though, especially Newmont, because Newmont is kind of the number one address to go to for American investors, that as this market really picks up steam, it's going to appreciate very much. But we have seen situations in the past with some major problems with their assets. not just Newmont, Barrick, and a number of other major players, and it's really pulled down the company. Barrick, a couple of years ago, decided that they were going to get into the copper business, and that really did a lot of damage to the bottom line. So that's why I favor the royalty companies. But of course, you know, I'm in the junior mining space. I run Orania, as you mentioned at the introduction, and that's a junior mining company. And yeah, that's where before, when we made the Fruta del Norte discovery in Ecuador, that was a project that appreciated 6,000% on the market. And that's where potentially you can make massive gains. But the investors should be very wary of listening to some of these promoters, you know, look at their track records, see what they've done in the past, and make sure that if they do invest in junior mining, that they're not just throwing their money away.
Well, listen, Keith, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you often write a lot on the subject. How can they do so?
Probably the best way to follow me is my blog. It's called straighttalkonmining.com. That's all one word, Straight Talk on Mining. And I have stuff written there going right back to 2001, and you can look at the archive. And I put some general interest stuff on there and a lot of information about mining, assaying, and things like that. I think your listeners would enjoy it very much.
Well, you know, it seems like there's a recession coming next year. That's what the indicators all seem to be showing clear across the board, but you'd never know that from some of the general chatter out there. As a matter of fact, the Fed this week caused a 300-point drop in the market by hinting that things were overheating and we had to slow things down. Well, why would they say that? I mean, the indicators just don't justify this idea. So this is the recession that isn't. Well, it hasn't come yet, and it probably will be. But for now, it isn't, as far as everybody's concerned. And then positing the idea that there is a recession next year, what is the pivot point, the markers leading up to it, and what do you need to do as an investor? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.